Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Hello and welcome to the A24 project here on the Nerd Party Network. Every 2 weeks, me and Dallas look at two films from the A24 filmography, and in between we try and bring you interviews with the talent involved in front of and behind the camera. In this special episode, I'm joined by filmmaker David Lowry, the writer-director of A Ghost Story and the upcoming Green Knight. It was a real pleasure to welcome David onto the show, and thanks to him for coming on. I hope you will enjoy this interview, and we'll see you again next week.
What were sort of your like early inspirations, and what was your sort of journey towards being a filmmaker?
I decided that I wanted to make movies when I was 7 years old, and it was entirely based upon my love of Star Wars. And I think my mom had checked a book out of the library for me about how Star Wars was made, and it seemed pretty good to me. It seemed like making movies was a pretty good time. So I just decided that that's what I wanted to do, and I've been on a one track journey ever since then.
You're sort of a jack of all trades. You're a producer, editor, filmmaker, writer. You worked across a lot of kind of different visual fields. Has that always been the appeal for you, to not just be kind of pigeonholed as a writer or a director?
Well, I think I've always wanted to be a director. That was always the goal, was to make my own movies. But I didn't go to film school, and I didn't really know how to do anything at all when I first started. So I just figured the best thing I could do for myself was just learn as much as possible. And as a result, I wound up wearing a lot of different hats on a lot of different projects. And I am, you know, if you look on IMDb, I've got a bazillion credits on things like a credit as a cinematographer on a couple movies. I am not a cinematographer. I'm a terrible cinematographer. But it was very useful to learn how it was useful to learn that I'm not good, you know. And so I always, you know, sought out, you know, projects to work on, things that my friends were making, things that friends of friends were making, anything I could work on to just learn more about how to make my own films. And at a certain point, you know, editing became a career for me for a couple of years, because I really loved it and I was pretty good at it. And it's one of my favorite parts of the filmmaking process. But, you know, in the back of my mind, it was always like, this is something I'm doing while I'm working on getting my own projects off the ground.
Did that sort of maybe kind of tie back into sort of your Star Wars inspirations? You know, you always think of something like George Lucas on those films, very much that sort of auteur kind of background. Did sort of that have an influence on you, or was there sort of other filmmakers that kind of pushed you down that road?
I'm sure that George Lucas, you know, remains, I mean, he still is. Like, I just watched Star Wars Episode 3, Revenge of the Sith, the other night, which was the last movie he directed. And say what you will about the movie, but I still admire what he was trying to do with those prequel trilogies, and I think, you know, they are auteurist works in their own way. And I think, you know, in 1994, when I was 13 years old, Pulp Fiction came out, and that really sort of ignited the concept of the writer-director in my head. You know, you see at the end of that movie, you see written and directed by Quentin Tarantino in that big, wonderful font. And I think that was the first time I really had an understanding of a director's voice. And so Tarantino certainly had an influence on me. And then over the years, that's been countless, you know, like the number of filmmakers who have since influenced me and inspired me and made me want to, you know, contribute to this craft. The list goes on and on, but I think those were the two early watermarks. It was, you know, George Lucas when I was, you know, 4, 5, 6 years old, and then Tarantino when I was 13 years old, and you know, a million more in between and a million more after, but those two are pretty seismic.
You're based in Texas, and we're used to sort of Hollywood and the industry, how it kind of works on the west coast of the USA. What's it like to be a creative talent in Texas, and what's the industry like there at the moment?
Well, I moved here when I was 7 years old, and to Dallas, which is where I still live. And I, you know, one of the very first things that I found out about Dallas was that this was where RoboCop was shot. and RoboCop was the first R-rated movie I ever saw, and I think I saw it shortly after moving here, against my parents' wishes. And so I always had like this idea that movies could get made here. You know, that was always part of the appeal of Dallas, was like, oh, there are films that get made here. I think that around the time that I moved here, Oliver Stone was making movies here with some degree of frequency. He did Born on the 4th of July, had a little bit here, and then of course JFK, and then when I was in high school, Any Given Sunday shot here as well, and I got to go be an extra in that, which was exciting for me. And so it felt like a place where things could get made. I had this concept in my head that I could make movies here. It was an acceptable place to make movies. Also, Wes Anderson came from Dallas and he shot his first movie here. And that came out when I was in high school. And definitely, you know, when you see Bottle Rocket in high school, you're like, oh, this just feels like something I could make with my friends. You know, I didn't quite understand, you know, what $5 million would buy me at that point, but just felt like the type of movie I could make. And I knew all those locations. It just looked so familiar. It's like when you see a movie that's shot in your own town, in your own backyard, and it's not LA, and it's not New York, it just makes it feel that much more manageable. So again, I mentioned I didn't go to film school, so I kind of just started making movies once I got out of high school. And I stayed here and kept doing it. And I had this idea in my head that I wasn't going to go to LA until I had a reason to go there as a filmmaker. I wasn't going to go there on my own dime. I was going to wait till someone brought me out there because they wanted to meet me or something like that. And that's actually what wound up happening. And I have lived in LA. I really like LA. I have done time in New York as well. Saying done time makes it sound like a bad thing, but I love New York as well. But there was a certain point in my life where I shifted from wanting to get out of Dallas to feeling like I kind of liked staying here. And now that I'm in my 30s, I do like staying here. I really kind of feel like it's good to get outside of the hubs of the industry to a place where the industry still exists, but is, you know, it's not huge here. There's stuff that shoots here. There, you know, people are employed as in the film crafts here, but there's not a ton of work. And that's a thing I'd like to change, of course. I'd like to bring more work here if I can, but it has this nice feeling of being just outside of the industry, just anonymous enough. No one really knows what Dallas is like. You know, no one has a good idea of the city itself, and I can kind of just disappear here, which is really helpful for me.
The first film of yours that caught my attention and was like the first time I'd heard of you was A Ghost Story. And I kind of dived into your films afterwards. I fell in love with the film and your style. What was the sort of genesis of A Ghost Story?
It came from a number of different places. I was finishing up Pete's Dragon. You know, I was in the last 4 or 5 months of post-production on that, and it had been a long process. It took about 3 years to make that movie, and that is a really long time for me because I have an incredibly short attention span, for better or for worse, and I can't pay attention to one thing for very long. So by the end of it, I really wanted to make something new. I wanted to focus on a different movie. And I loved Pete's Dragon. I mean, that's one of my favorite movies I've ever made, but I was ready to be done with it. And so I just started to think about Saint Nick, my first feature, and how we had made that, you know, in 14 days for $12,000 in an abandoned house. And I just was getting very nostalgic about that and just wanted to make a movie like that again. And I'd had this idea, I don't know how far back, but this idea of making a haunted house movie where the ghost would be someone in a bed sheet. And so I just started letting that idea percolate over a couple of weeks. And then I read this article about a fault line on the Pacific Northwest. It was a article in the New Yorker, I believe, and it won the Pulitzer Prize and freaked everybody in America out because it was just about how America is well overdue for the North American continent is well overdue for a, you know, earth-shattering earthquake. And it really just made me feel like our world is fragile. I already felt that, like, on a cultural level, on a societal level, and all of a sudden I realized, oh yeah, and the world itself as a physical object, geologically, is incredibly fragile, and it's not going to put up with us for much longer. And so I kind of had a little bit of a freak out about that, and a little bit of an existential crisis, and that sort of you know, kickstarted the writing process for A Ghost Story, which took all of one night. And I wrote it, and then, you know, I was like, this is a movie that I can make in 14 days for $12,000 in an abandoned house. And I sent it to my producing partners, and I was like, let's shoot this, you know, let's make this as soon as we wrap on Pete's Dragon in June, let's shoot it in the time between, you know, the movie was going to open in August. And I was like, that's 2 months. Let's go shoot the movie. So that's where it came from. And it wound up being a little longer than 14 days and a little more expensive than $12,000, but it was still, you know, a pretty manageable movie.
I remember sort of reading about that sort of script being written in a day. How did that develop over time, that script, or did it largely kind of remain the same from first initial draft to kind of shoot?
The first draft was 10 pages, and then, like, over the next week, I expanded it to 30 pages. And I honestly can't remember what came out of those additional 20 pages. I think there was more material with Casey and Rooney. You know, there was more dialogue with them at the beginning. And that kept changing, too, while we were shooting. I kept writing more scenes. You know, we shot enough material with them to almost comprise an entire feature film. You know, just sort of a slice of life of a married couple in trouble. And there's very little of that in the movie, but we just shot a lot of it so that we'd have material to play with in the edit. And all of that was written in one stage or another. And, you know, I think that 10 page draft did have the monologue that Will Oldham gives at the party. That was in there, but, I can't remember what else changed. But it was, you know, the intent was there, you know, even at 10 pages, it was probably pretty close to the finished film. And then the 30 page script is very close. There's not a lot of difference there. It's, you know, scene for scene, very, very close to what we shot.
How long was the sort of film's production from this inception, this one day kind of script, to shooting kind of Rooney Mara and Casey Affleck on set?
I think, you know, the script was probably early March that I wrote it, and we shot it in June and July. But we, you know, we shot for 19 days initially. We did like a 19-day shoot. And somewhere around day 12 or 13, Toby Holbrooks, my producing partner, came up to me and was like, hey, why don't we not tear down the house? Like, why don't we hold off on that, and you go edit the movie and see what else we need. And then once we shot that stuff, then we'll tear it down. And that was like just a brilliant idea. It was really, really smart, because initially on day 20, we were going to tear down the house and that was going to be it. And so after those 19 days of photography were up, I went and I cut the movie. And we then released Pete's Dragon, and the day after Pete's Dragon came out, went back to Texas, and we regrouped and shot for another seven or eight days. And those 7 or 8 days were some really essential beats, you know, things that I really would not have had we not held off on tearing down the house. And then once we had all of those, we did tear down the house, which was a very exciting and therapeutic event. And then over the course of the fall, you know, that was late August that we did that, early September. And then over the next few months, we'd get together two or three more times and just shoot just a couple extra little things. It was really nice to have such a small production, because it allowed us to do things like that. You know, if I needed a shot, I was able to pretty much just go and get it, as long as it didn't involve the house anymore. So there are a lot of shots in the film, just little bits and bobs that are things that I was able to just go pick up here and there over the course of the remaining months of post-production. And, you know, I think if you totaled it all up, it was like 29 and a half days of shooting, all said and done. But that was spread out over 6 months.
What was it like going from, say, Pete's Dragon, this sprawling film shot down in New Zealand with CGI dragons, you know, large cast to making something like a ghost story so quickly afterwards? Did it take a little bit of time to get back into that small feature kind of mindset, or was it something you were immediately able to kind of fall back into?
I was able to fall back into it quite quickly, but there wasn't really anything to fall back into because it felt the same. You know, the weird thing about making movies is that they generally kind of feel the same no matter what the scale is. And I didn't know that then, but I do know that now. and it's really remarkable. You know, the production of a movie is like imminently scalable, and whatever means you have, however big the crew is, however big the cast is, however much money you have, it all ends up filling the same box to the same extent. And you deal with all the same problems, and you find the same solutions, and you're using the same tools and the same, you know, you're using the same creative muscles. And so it kind of just felt the same. And I was expecting it to feel different. I was expecting Pete's Dragon to feel different from my previous films, but it felt the same as those. And then Ghost Story felt the same as Pete's Dragon. And so by now when I make a movie, I'm kind of just used to the idea that it's going to just feel the same. Like, no matter what, there's always going to be different contexts and different circumstances because you're telling a different story. But the mindset with which you approach that storytelling procedure is usually the same. And you know, at this point, you're kind of using the same gear from one movie to the next. Like, everyone shoots on Alexas or Reds these days. You're not really... You know, it's pretty rare to break out a film camera, and that can change things. Like, an Old Man and the Gun we shot on film, and that was a nice change of pace. I felt a little bit different, but usually it's all kind of the same. And there was it was a surprise, but there's a degree of comfort to that as well.
You reunited with Rooney Mara and Casey Affleck on this film. Were they always sort of your first choices to be in this film? Obviously, you'd worked with them previously on Eight and Them Body Saints.
They were, but I didn't think anyone was going to do it. You know, it was such a crazy idea. This, you know, the whole movie was such a lark that I sent the script to them fully expecting them both to just be like, nah, call us with the next one, you know, like, call us when you're making a real movie. But they both just said yes. And so that was it. And it wasn't like I wrote the parts for them, but when, you know, I wrote the script and was going to get ready to make it, I just was like, it'd be kind of funny if Casey and Rooney were in it, I'll send it to them. And they both said yes. So, I mean, I'm incredibly grateful that they did say yes and that they trusted me and that they wanted to make something like this. I mean, it's a big testament to them as creative people that they would jump aboard something as bizarre as this. I mean, there was no way in making the movie that anyone, whether it was the cast or the crew, would have had a clue as to whether it would have turned out the way it did. It just, you know, we shot a lot of material and a lot of bad material, and everyone just trusted that somehow we were going to turn it into something good. And they trusted me, and I really am grateful for that.
I think the trust comes from the audience. Did you have any worries that the audience wouldn't trust you or wouldn't be able to kind of go along with this film and its kind of design?
Definitely. I mean, my goal with this was to make a movie that I would like, that I would want to go see. And so I knew that if I could achieve that, then there would be at least like 5 people that would probably agree with me and like it. But beyond that, I wasn't expecting it to really have much reach. You know, I didn't expect it to go very far. I figured it would be a very, you know, a very niche audience for this film. So really the threshold for me was like making sure I liked it and making sure it worked for me. And there was a long period where it didn't and where I just felt it was a disaster. But at a certain point, as with most movies that I make, they clicked into place and started to work, and I became, you know, I became a captive audience to it. I really started to enjoy it, and it was a movie that I wasn't compromising on in any shape, way, or form. It was a movie that, like, this is a movie just for me. Like, when you make a movie like Pete's Dragon, you have to think about the audience. You have to think about every audience member. You have to make a movie that is appealing, hopefully, to every person in the world. That's the ideal thing. And that's not a great way to make a movie, but, you know, when you're making a movie at that scale, that's what it needs to kind of do in order to be successful. And I think we did a pretty good job of it, but it was definitely like, you know, you're always thinking like, okay, well, this makes me laugh, but we'll make a 7-year-old laugh. And with A Ghost Story, it was just like, this is just for me. Like, no one else needs to ever enjoy this movie, but I want to make something that I like. And I did. And the fact that so many other people also like it is both alarming and surprising, but also, like, so deeply gratifying that I can't even put it into words.
It's one of those things when you were kind of touching on it there that you had this fear that kind of evaporated. What was the moment that you thought, this is all working, and you kind of, the confidence started to surge through you?
It happened in waves. The first time was like about a week into production, maybe 10 days into production, and I cut together like the first 20 minutes of the movie, and it was long and unwieldy, but it was working. Like, the one shot led to the next in a really satisfying way, and you could see a path forward, and you could also see like where we needed to reshoot things, which is what we ended up doing. But that was the first hint that this was something worth persevering on. And then in post, you know, I think I went through a long period of just like, you know, depression over it, just feeling shapeless. And I think really once I managed to get Casey as the ghost to show up within the first, you know, 15 minutes of the movie, that's when it started working. I think earlier on, I think the first cut probably took him about 30 or 45 minutes to become the ghost. And that's, you know, it was way too long. You felt like you were watching a different movie, and all of a sudden, it, you know, would take this sudden left turn into this ghost comedy, and it just wasn't, it didn't have any shape or forward momentum to it. And so once I got rid of a lot of material at the beginning, a lot of that material with Casey and Rooney that we'd shot, then it really started to kind of click into place. And then there were other, you know, sort of like moments throughout post where, you know, you would try things and all of a sudden a bolt of lightning would strike, or, you know, whatever sort of metaphor for creative inspiration you like that would occur. And the movie would get incrementally better. And one of those was like the scene where Rooney listens to the song that happened originally, you know, at the beginning of the movie. That was part of the big sequence at the beginning. It was taking so long, and I needed there to be a turning point later in the film. And I knew that at a certain point, time wasn't going to matter. And I was like, well, what if time just stops mattering earlier? What if we cast aside sequential value earlier and just kind of have a flashback that kind of serves as a dramatic fulcrum in the present? And so moving that scene to where it was, I think, was like one of the big, you know, big moments where the movie really went up a couple notches in terms of how well it was functioning. And so there were a lot of things like that.
What made you pick that song? I absolutely love that song. It's become actually a staple of my running playlist. What was it about this song that you thought, this is the one for this film?
It was something that Daniel Hart had written and played for me while we were working on the score to Pete's Dragon, which was right around the time when, you know, I was working on developing the idea for this project, you know, the February, March of 2016. And I heard it and just was like, this is the best song you've ever written. It's an incredible piece of music. And B, it feels like the movie I'm working on right now. Like, it feels like this little script I'm writing. And I asked him if I could use it in the movie. I didn't know how yet, but I just was like, I want to use this in the movie. And he said yes, and I made a couple changes, and suddenly Casey's character was a musician, and the song was something that, you know, would connect him and Rooney, and that was that. It was probably one of those changes that occurred between the 10-page draft and the 30-page draft.
I've always thought that when you touched on sort of the script earlier on, that there is very little in the way of dialogue in this film. I wondered how much of that script and plan is sort of writing down sort of visual imagery and kind of talking and sort of putting faith in sort of Daniel to bring together this amazing score that he does to sort of carry the film through if there's not going to be the emphasis on dialogue.
You know, when I first was conceiving of the film, I probably imagined there would be very little music at all. I kind of imagined it more abstract and less emotional. You know, I think I always set out to make movies that are very cold and unemotional, that are more, you know, there's something that I always want to put a barrier between the audience and the movie for some reason. I don't know why, but I always want there to be like this sort of like cool analytic quality to my work and this an austerity that would almost, you know, negate the need for music. And at some point in the process of making my films, they get more emotional, and I want there to be music. I want there to be that bridge for the audience. I want there to be that warmth that you get from having musical accompaniment. And so I'm sure in the script, you know, there was a lot of description of, you know, there, I know there was a description of like what the images were and how long they would last. And, you know, there was a suggestion of a very, very austere, very formal, very cold movie that was largely comprised of static images that we would observe for long periods of time. And all I can say is that over the course of production, the pulse of the movie quickened.
How much kind of thought went into the development of this sheet, this ghost sheet, and how did that sort of work for kind of shooting?
You know, I thought it was just going to be a bed sheet, and we'd just throw it over the actor and cut some holes in the eyes, and that was going to be all we'd need. And we tried that and realized that that doesn't look like what we wanted it to look like. It looks like someone with a sheet over their head. And it's a good shorthand for a ghost, but it doesn't feel like a ghost. And in spite of the goofy sort of aesthetic that we were going for with this spirit, we still wanted it to feel supernatural. And so, you know, what you realize, you need it to look like a cartoon drawing of a ghost rather than an actual person with a sheet over their head. And so Anel Brodor, our costume designer, you know, built this costume that had a lot of structure to it. You know, the fabric was important, choosing the right fabric and so that it would hang right, and then building the structure underneath it so that it would flare out the right way, have the right shape to it. It had to have a helmet so that you would always have the right shape on the head, and you wouldn't see the actor's eyes, and there would always be a, you know, a very uniform face. And then to get the folds of the sheet looking right, you know, we basically had to puppeteer it. And so anytime the ghost was not in a full body shot, you know, there's always at least two people hanging out around his feet, just holding the edges of the sheet taut so that the folds would function the way we wanted to. You know, if he turned his head the wrong way, they'd get bunched up, or they would just start to look goofy. And so we wanted them to always have a you know, sort of sinewy flow to them, and that required a lot of puppeteering. It was a real to-do, but we figured it out.
One of my kind of favorite touches was when the ghost poofs away. How did you sort of achieve that with this sort of costume, as it were?
That was literal magic. My aforementioned producing partner Toby Halbrechts is also a magician, and he knows a lot of professional magicians, and so we employed a few of them on this movie. And it is an old stage trick, which I will not reveal how it's done because magicians don't like to give away their secrets. But that was one of a couple of tricks that we used that were little things that you would assume you could do with CG or with, you know, who knows how. But we went back to some old authentic stage magic to pull off that and a couple other little effects in the movie as well.
You also get to appear as the neighbor ghost. So, what was it like to be underneath that sheet? Was it what you expected, or was it sort of, oh my God, how has Casey managed to pull this off?
Yeah, it sucks. It's not comfortable to wear, and it's super hot. And we were shooting in Texas in the summer when it's like 105 degrees out, and it was definitely, it definitely, you know, thankfully I'm not claustrophobic, because I think if I was, it would have been a, you know, I wouldn't have worn it. Neither would Casey. No one would have worn that thing. But it was definitely, you know, puts you in a certain mindset. I'll just put it that way.
One thing I did not expect at all, like I loved the trailer, and then when I went to see the film opening weekend, what surprised me and caught me completely off guard was the scope of the film in terms of how much time it covers. I didn't expect that and anticipate that, and I thought it just made this film so special. Were the periods in time that sort of we see this ghost through in terms of the future and the past, were they always set in stone, or was there sort of multiple ideas about how far in the future it could go, what the future might look like, or how far into the past it might go as well?
It was pretty set in stone. I didn't really, improvise too much there. I was like, we'll go to when this plot of land was first developed as a domestic environment. The first time someone laid out for a house on this tract of land. And, some vague period in the American West felt like the right time period for that. And it made sense that no one would have built a house earlier than that. So we started there. And then going into the future, there's always like, you could always go further. You could always go to like the decimation of the world, the stuff that Will Oldham actually talks about in his monologue. But it didn't need, it would have been out of balance if we had just kept going. So I just was like, let's go to a Blade Runner future. And luckily Dallas has a pretty futuristic skyline already. And Weta Digital did some enhancements, added some buildings, added a little flying car to it. But it's downtown Dallas looks kind of Blade Runner-ish, it turns out. And then, we added more. That was an area where we added some stuff, like some pickups, like the stuff of him walking around the office building. And we filled it in a little bit just so it wouldn't be quite so big of a jump. We wanted to take a little bit of time getting to the future, but nevertheless, all of that stuff was pretty much in the script.
One of the most dialogue heavy scenes you've touched on is the scene with Will Oldham. It's a powerful piece of dialogue. How much of yourself did you, and yourself and your kind of worldview did you invest into that scene?
I mean, it's 100% me. It's just me working through some issues. And I can say that about all of my movies. All of my movies are therapeutic to some degree, and they're all me reflecting on myself and just kind of digging deep. But this one certainly was just, I was like, here are some thoughts I'm having. I'm going to put them down in dialogue form, and we're going to shoot them. And so that very much reflects me trying to justify persevering in what it is that I do.
Did you expect this really heartfelt pie scene to sort of resonate so much with audiences and become so popular with viewers?
I knew that it would be something. Like I knew that it would be, I kind of figured it would be the moment where people either stick with the movie or give up on it. I was like, that's this moment where people are gonna like walk out of the theater, or it's the moment where they're gonna sit down and be into it. I didn't know if it would be emotional for people. I have a real difficulty gauging emotion. Like I'm not, like I said, like I don't set out to make emotional movies. I don't ever want to, sit down and like say, I'm gonna write a tearjerker today. That's never my intent. But I try to be emotionally sincere in what I do, and I knew that that moment needed to be an emotionally cathartic one. And I knew that just because of what it was, because of how long it was going to be and how restrained it was going to be, that it was going to be a moment that if people saw the movie, they would probably remember it. So there was some degree of like, we knew that that was an important moment in the movie. And if it worked, it would be something people would talk about. As with the movie at large, I didn't expect it to connect the way that it has, or to become, I didn't know it was going to be as iconic, so to speak, as it has become. And I'm glad it is. I mean, I think it's probably the best scene I've ever directed, and maybe it will remain that. I don't know if I'll ever do something like that again, but it is, it's emotionally sincere in the best possible way, and I think audiences respond because of that. And I should probably take a lesson from that.
I know Rooney Mara wrote this note, and it's a mystery to yourself and to the audiences. What's it like to have had this moment where it's almost kind of up there with sort of something like Lost in Translation, where people are debating and discussing what was this note that she wrote and put into the wall? Was that another moment that you maybe thought would become something a bit special, or did that kind of surprise you when the audience met the film?
That one did surprise me, you know, because I'm the type of audience member that just accepts things like that. Like, I never wondered what Bill Murray said to Scarlett Johansson. And I was like, we're not meant to know. It's a private thing. We don't need to know that. And I guess I've got like a lack of inquisition in my mind, but I definitely, assume the note would just be like that. I'd be like, oh, this is clearly something we're not meant to know, so we're never going to find out. And it turns out that people do want to know those things, and I should keep that in mind. But it was definitely, probably the number one question I got when we were doing the press tour and going to screenings and doing Q&As, and I always felt bad letting people down, and saying I just honestly don't know. But I honestly don't know.
You've kept the film in sort of it's a largely sort of secret, small production. What was it like when it was time to start looking for distributors and sellers? Was it a nervous experience starting to share it with the industry? And what sort of reactions did you sort of receive?
It wasn't really like nervous because, we self-financed the movie, and the budget was low enough that, if we'd never sold it, it wasn't going to be disastrous. Like, it'd be helpful to sell it because we spent money on it, but it definitely was like we made it at a price point where we knew that we could afford to lose that money, which was a luxurious position to be in. And that was the same way we made Saint Nick, my first movie, for $12,000. Like, we never got distribution on that, not because we didn't have offers, but it was just like we didn't need it. We could afford to not make our money back on that. It was because it was only $12,000. And this was a larger production, but still, it was the same ethos. We're like, if we don't have the right type of distribution, we don't need to have it. We don't need to get it out into the world. But that being said, we always, from the very beginning, thought it would be really, this feels like the type of movie that I would like to see the A24 logo in front of. It felt like I've been wanting to work with them. I've admired their movies and the way that they put them out into the world. And so when we were getting close to finishing it, my agent introduced us to some of the folks there, and we basically just told them, like, look, we want you guys to distribute this movie. And we showed them 6 minutes of it. I kind of cut together a 6-minute trailer. It was sort of like ultimately very close to the trailer they released, but 6 minutes long. And I was like, we can't show you the whole movie yet because it's not done. I just don't want you to see it till it's done. But here's a reel of footage. This is what it feels like. And we talked about it, and they were really into it. And then ultimately, as we got, but then the movie got into Sundance, and as it got closer to Sundance, we eventually showed them the whole thing. And by the time we were at Sundance, they had agreed to distribute it, so they'd come on board. And so we never showed it to anyone else. We just, it was one of those things where, like, I kind of just felt like they were the right place, and that kind of goes against like the way the marketplace is supposed to work. You're supposed to make something and then show it to people and kind of get excitement about it, and maybe have a bidding war. But this movie, I didn't want that for this movie. There's a time and place for that, but with this film, I really just was like, there's a home that I feel it needs to have, and there's a lot of good homes it could have, but there's one that I feel is just right for it, and I kind of just want to stick to that. And if they'll have us, we'll just go with them. So that was the beginning of our partnership with A24.
What has that partnership been like? Because you've done it twice, sort of. You've got the upcoming Green Knight, you had this film, and you produced Never Going Back. What are they kind of like as sort of partners to work with, and how have you kind of found that?
I mean, the best thing I can say is that, with every step of the way in my career, I've always tried to just work with my friends. You look at the credits on my movies, and there's a lot of familiar names from one movie to the next, like Jade Healy, my production designer, James and Toby, my producers, Daniel Hart, my composer. There's a lot of, we keep coming back to the same folks because we just like making movies with our friends. It's really fun and really satisfying and gratifying. And now I can say that, my friends include our distributor. And so I really hope that friendship can endure. And, you know, not every movie I make will be right for them, but I want to keep finding movies that are, because it really is, I really enjoy working with them.
What have been some of the highlights of their filmography for you?
There's a lot of them. Under the Skin, I suppose, is probably still number one for me, just because that's one of my favorite movies. I really love that movie. And I'll just put it on. I put it on again the other night. I really enjoy just having it on in my house. That one's probably the top.
What was sort of the first public reactions to the film like? What was it like to then go, right, here's the audience, will they meet the film? And as you say, there's scenes where they go, this could be the moment that they potentially walk out or stay with the film. What were those experiences kind of like? And what was it like watching the film kind of continue to grow and grow in sort of its popularity?
It was crazy. I mean, I didn't expect it. You know, I don't watch my movies once they're done. I can't sit through the premiere. It's too stressful. So I went to Sundance and we went up, you know, we premiered on a Sunday, which was great because I got to just kind of hang out and enjoy other movies. I was on the jury that year for short film, so I was just busy being a jurist for a juror for shorts and watching a lot of great shorts. And then Sunday morning came and no one had seen it. No one knew anything. I think one journalist had seen it and done an interview, and I knew that he had liked it, so that was nice. And what happened? I went to the library theater and went and introduced the movie, and then I left. I went back to my house and read a book, and 90 minutes later went back, and I was standing with, you know, Noah Sacco and David Finkel and Daniel Katz from A24 in the back of the theater, and they seemed pretty happy. They'd stayed and watched it, and then the lights came up and there was a bunch of applause, and I was like, oh, that's good. You know, not many people had left, it seemed, and did the Q&A, and that went well. And then as soon as it was over, they were like, you should look at Twitter. And I was like, well, I'm not on Twitter, so I can't. And they just were like, people are liking it. People are really liking it. And that was great to know. You know, it was really good. It's really necessary for me to have a detached mindset, because it could go anyway. I can never, you never know what an audience is going to think. You can, as with the case with this one, I did my best to make myself happy. And with other movies, I'm always trying to, like, maybe meet the audience halfway. But with this one, it was like, I felt confident that I liked it, so I kind of didn't care. I did care. I cared deeply. I really want the audience to like it, but I felt I wasn't trying too hard with this one. You know, with Ain't Nobody's Saints, I was trying really hard to make something that would appeal to the most people like possible, but it wasn't a Disney movie. It wasn't Pete's Dragon. And so it kind of like felt neither here nor there ultimately. But this movie, it was all there. It was where it needed to be. And I was really happy that people liked it, really surprised that they liked it as much as they did, and it was, you know, a really special experience to have it like then get out into the world and for that momentum to be maintained. It never kind of hit a wall. It never just like, the hype never got ahead of it. It never became something that people turned on. It just became a little movie that found the audience that it was meant for, and I couldn't have planned that. You can never plan that, but it worked out in a really beautiful way.
One of the films that came after this, sort of between A Ghost Story and The Green Knight, was the wonderful The Old Man and the Gun, and you reunited with Robert Redford for his final film. I mean, I adored the film, and I've had this odd always thing that somewhat amused me and baffled me. I remember going to see Old Man and a Gun, and then when I caught Avengers Endgame on opening night and there he popped, I was like, oh, but I wanted sort of Old Man and the Gun. That was meant to be the final movie. Why has he popped up in this Avengers movie? It kind of made me chuckle and sort of feel a bit frustrated for the Old Man and the Gun. What was your kind of experience in that film like? And I've always wondered, did that sort of appearance in Avengers Endgame make you go, oh, God, that's kind of played off a bit on sort of the Old Man and the Gun, sort of what sort of the film was kind of bringing in perhaps an audience for as well?
We knew it was happening because he left our movie, like the last day of shooting, he flew to Atlanta and he was like, I'm doing one day on the Avengers. And we're like, whoa, what are you doing? Like, we thought your character died. And he's like, I have no idea. I'll find out tomorrow. Like he knew he was going to be in it. He didn't know what it was going to be yet. And he didn't know which one it was going to be, because we knew it was two films, and he had no idea whether it was the first one or the second one. So we went to see Avengers Infinity War, and we're crossing our fingers that he would be in that one, because that one came out first. And when he was, and we're like, oh, well, I guess we have the second to last Robert Redford movie, but, you know, it's fine. I don't think he'll probably act again in something else. Like, I don't think we're really his last movie, although we're probably like his last leading role. And I was happy to see him in Avengers. I thought it was pretty funny that, you know, if that's his last movie, that his final line is "Give me the briefcase, Stark," or whatever it is he says. But anyway, we knew it was coming, and we were looking forward to seeing it. We went from Sundance with A Ghost Story and flew to Ohio and started shooting Old Man the Gun right afterwards. It came, you know, right on the heels of that. And I was really glad that I had that. You know, it's a very different movie from A Ghost Story, and it had been in development for a long time. And, you know, it went through a lot of fits and starts, and it took me a long time to get a script that I was happy with and that Redford was happy with. And I think that had A Ghost Story come out earlier, or had Old Man the Gun not been ready to go, I probably would have just walked away from it, because I was just been like, you know, after making something like A Ghost Story, which is so personal and so, so special. Like, you know, I'm not going to like pretend it's not. Like, it's a maybe once in a career movie. I don't know. Like, we'll see. But it had the reaction to it was so beautiful and so meaningful. And I took it seriously that had I not had another movie to go make, I don't know what I would have made next. You know, I would have felt like this sense of like, I got to live up to A Ghost Story now. But luckily I had this completely different movie ready to go, and we were already in prep. So I was able to just sort of set A Ghost Story aside and go focus on something completely different. And that was really useful. It really helped keep me grounded at a moment when, you know, I was getting a lot of accolades. that's important. And it was also nice to have something so different to focus on, because there's no way for Old Man the Gun to compare to A Ghost Story, because it's a completely different movie. Aside from the fact that I made it and that it's personal to me in a different way, there's no common ground between the two, and that's very useful. It's like nice to have something so different to bounce off of, and that's something I, you know, continue to do with the movies I choose to make. They're all very different, but in that case particularly, it was really great to have something so. I hesitate to use the word normal, because Old Man the Gun is abnormal in its own way, but compared to A Ghost Story, it was a very traditional movie, and it was, I think, necessary for me to make a movie like that so that I could just sort of recalibrate after the experience of making A Ghost Story.
Coming up next, and obviously it won't be one you would be able to talk about too much, is The Green Knight. And obviously I feel so sorry for all of you guys. It's been kind of delayed due to sort of this lockdown we're in at the moment, and obviously South by Southwest got affected. What's kind of the state of play, as best you know, sort of with the film at the moment?
I mean, no one knows. That's the case with everything at the moment. No one knows anything. And we can guess and we can hope, but all I can say is that at some point audiences will see it, and they'll see it in the best way possible, given the circumstances. So hopefully that's in theaters. Hopefully theaters survive. I'm a big time defender of the theatrical experience. And one of the things I love about A24 is that they are as well. You know, the vast majority of their films go to the theaters, go to the big screen before they hit VOD and home video. So I hope that there are theaters to come back to. But if not, I want people to see the movie. You know, I hope that if I were just an audience member and I'd been stuck at home for 6 months and I wanted to see a new movie, I'd rather see it at home than not see it at all. So I'm confident it'll be seen soon, but soon is variable. And in the meantime, like the nice, one of the few silver linings is that I like to, you know, sit on movies for a little while after they're done to make sure that they really are done. And we were really rushing to try to get it done for South by Southwest, you know, and the movie, if we'd shown it there, would not have been fully finished. It would have been close, but not quite done. And so now we're at a point where everything's shut down and we're mostly done. You know, if we had to release the movie tomorrow, it would be pretty close to where it needs to be. But we're able to take a breather and sit with it. And if any improvements come to mind over the duration, however long that duration is, it'll be nice to have, it'll be a luxury to get to go in and make some tweaks. So that's the one silver lining. And it's not a great one, but I'll take it because we need all the silver linings we can get right now.
Yeah, I noticed there has been like some discussion about sort of Amazon providing like a platform for South by Southwest films. Kind of what's your feeling on this? Do you think this is something you could maybe imagine Green Knight going to, or do you think, as I say, just sort of sitting on it and eventually the time will come for the film to get released?
Yeah, I think that Amazon South by partnership is great. And had I been at South by with my film Saint Nick that came out in 2009, I would have jumped on that. I would have absolutely jumped on that. But in our case, we were one of the lucky films already had distribution. We weren't going to the festival to seek distribution or to, you know, make a name for the film. It was a launch for the movie. And so that was, for us, it was a lucky place to be because we were able to, we can pivot, you know. The movie wasn't depending on that premiere. But I've been in that position before. I've been in that position where, like, you know, in 2009 when I had St. Nick there, if that festival had been canceled and they had not been able to show my movie, I probably would not be talking to you today. You know, I'm sure I would be making movies, but I don't know in what direction my career would have gone. So for all the filmmakers in that position, that's who it really affects. And I really feel for them. And I really hope that all these alternative means of distribution or exhibition or whatever, you know, whatever shape the festival circuit of 2020 takes over the ensuing months, you know, I hope they're able to utilize it. And honestly, I think at this point, if you have official selection of South by Southwest 2020 on your poster and your trailer, that's a badge of honor. You've been through some shit to get that at this point. And I hope all the filmmakers who have that wear it proudly.
What attracted you to sort of the Arthurian kind of legend? Has this always been some kind of period of history and a genre that's some appeal to you?
Yeah, the first script I ever wrote when I was like seven was a adaptation of Sir Percival and the Fisher King. I really got into Grail mythology after Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. Like, that was like, you know, I'd never heard of the Holy Grail before and watched that movie and loved it because I just loved Indiana Jones and got into the Grail myths as a result of that, which of course are very inclusive of King Arthur and his knights. So it was always something that I kind of, you know, I liked. It wasn't a particular, you know, source of, shall I say, like, it wasn't what I, you know, I wasn't a scholar in my off time of Arthurian lore, but I had an affinity for it. And I, you know, around the time I was finishing Old Man the Gun, you know, I was just kind of thinking about what I wanted to make next, much in the same way that I was thinking about after Ghost Story or after Peace Dragon, what I wanted to do that, you know, was sort of left of center. And I just was thinking about Willow, the Ron Howard movie, which I was also a really big fan of, and just thought it'd be fun to make a weird fantasy quest movie. I was trying to think of something I could do low budget again. And I was like, wow, if a character is just traveling, you know, across the landscape, that's pretty low budget. That's pretty affordable. We could make a movie like that. And I could do a movie about a knight on a journey and a knight on a quest and keep the cost pretty low and just one actor traveling, like, no problem. And of course, it quickly turned into something much bigger than that, as these things tend to do. I just took that inclination to make a movie like that and just sort of attached it to Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, which was, you know, one of the canonical Western texts that you read in your freshman English class, if you're an English major, which I was. And I'd always liked that story and felt that there was room for cinematic interpretation that had not been taken yet. And so I reread the poem and wrote the script at the same time. I was just writing as I went. And by the end of it, it was definitely bigger than a one night journey across the landscape movie. And I was pretty sure no one would ever pay for it. But cut to 3 months later, we were in Ireland scouting locations. So it came together pretty quickly.
I love that you've cast Dev Patel. I think he's continuing year on year to be such a great leading man. Was he always sort of in mind for this role for you?
He wasn't. You know, I didn't really have anyone in mind for it. And it was, you know, I didn't write it with a foreign actor, which sometimes I do, sometimes I don't. And so I really just wanted to find someone who, you know, the character of Gawain in the poem is like the, you know, the most honorable knight in Arthur's court. And the one big change I made in adapting it was like, I need him to get there, but I don't want him to be there at the beginning. And so I wanted the character to be kind of a tool, just kind of like a he's not like a horrible person, but he's someone who probably thinks he's better than he is. And just is not a, he's a guy with a lot of room for self-improvement. And I wanted to make sure that I could have him be that type of character, but that the audiences wouldn't reject him. So I needed someone who was charismatic and just would endear themselves to the audience, no matter how much of an asshole he may be. And when I met Dev, you know, I'd seen his movies, and I had not really thought of him for the part, but his agent called me and was like, you should really think about him for this. I think he'd be good. And so I rewatched Lion, and just watching Lion and thinking about him playing a medieval knight, it instantly clicked. Like, I was like, oh wait, yeah, there's a nobility, a regality to him. He has a knightly countenance already. And the idea of seeing him on a horse with a sword and an axe, like all of a sudden, like the movie started to click into place on a visual level that it hadn't before. And then when I met him, he's just such a wonderful person, such a warm and empathetic and caring human being. He's so enthusiastic about everything he does. I instantly liked him, and I was like, audiences are going to love this guy. Like they will follow him on any journey, no matter where he goes. And it just felt like the right fit. As soon as I met him, as soon as I sat down with him in person, I was like, this is the guy, he's got to do it. And so luckily his schedule was just clear enough that he was able to come do it. And it was a really, you know, he's fantastic in the movie.
It looks like it's got a fantastic cast. I'm really excited for it. On a personal level, one thing that got me excited in the trailer when I was watching it was when I heard Kate Dickie's wonderful Scottish accent. She's definitely one of our finest exports. What was it like to work with Kate Dickie?
She's just a delight, just an utter delight. And it was so fun. Like, you know, I loved her in The Witch. That was the first time I kind of like really became aware of her. And then since then, every time I see her in anything, I'd seen Red Road, the Andrea Arnold movie, but it took me a long time to connect that was her. You know, like I knew her from The Witch. Like The Witch made such a big impression on me.
Once you notice her in things, like she appears everywhere. Like she has just got that vibe of her, like, oh, you see her in this film, and then wait, she's in that one. Like I remembered watching The Last Jedi, like when it first came out, I was like, yeah, wait, that's Kate Dickie's working on The Empire or something like that.
I know, she's great. And Ralph Ineson's in that too. It was really fun. He told me that they had a whole backstory between their characters, that their Imperial officers were having an affair on the Star Destroyer. Anyway, side note about Star Wars, because I'm a Star Wars dork. But she was just a delight to work with. Just so fun, so warm, and just hilarious. Like, she is so funny. And she would just be sitting there trying to make Sean Harris laugh in between takes when they're sitting there on those thrones. And it was just the best. And she always had, like, you know, like these like neon pink trainers on underneath those robes. So every time she'd like get down from the throne, like she'd like lift up her skirt so she wouldn't trip, and this queen, this regal, you know, queen with this crazy decaying makeup would all of a sudden just have these bright neon trainers, and I was like, that's Kate in a nutshell. She put on her iPod headphones and just, you know, walk off back to craft services and hang out, and I just love her so much.
Can't wait. It's definitely going to be worth the wait. And just kind of after this, I noticed as well that you're returning back to sort of Disney with Peter Pan and Wendy. When can sort of audiences expect that, and how's that film kind of coming along sort of in the pre-production stage?
Well, that's another big wait and see right now, but we were due to start shooting in just over a month. Sets were being built. We cast all the kids. We were doing stunt training and getting everything up and running. And then, like the rest of the world, all of a sudden that big pause button got pressed. So right now we don't really know when it will come out or when we'll start shooting it. I don't like to entertain an if in that equation. I like to keep it to a when, but maybe there's an if to it as well, and we'll just have to wait and see. I started writing. We got, that project came to us. Disney brought the idea of doing that to me before Pete's Dragon came out, right around the time that I was getting ready to do a ghost story, and we actually started working on the script before we even started shooting the ghost story. So it's been in the works for a long time, and obviously, there are no shortage of Peter Pan movies in the world, but I really want to do this, and I feel like this is one that I like at this point. Like, I just need to do this for me. Like, I really feel personally connected to this script, and it's a movie I really want to make, and hopefully, audiences want to go see it as well. I think it'll be a good movie, and I'm really excited to make it. But when we'll get to make it, I don't know. We'll see how long Disney is willing to pay for a sound stage with a bunch of half-finished sets on it, and we're all hoping, that we can get back to it soon because it was really getting to an exciting stage. Like, we were getting ready to go. It was a couple weeks out, but and it was supposed to come out next July, and at this point, that's definitely not going to happen because all their releases have shifted. But I'll remain optimistic. But in the meantime, I'm also writing other things, and at some point, if I need to get back to my old habit of doing stop motion animation, just because there's no other way to make movies, I'll do that.
Do you enjoy blending sort of indie with Disney and these blockbuster adventures? Is it something that you're like actively looking to do, sort of mixing the two kind of styles of filmmaking?
It's not like I'm trying to like find a balance. It's just that I like all sorts of different types of movies, and I don't want to limit myself to any one type. The big budget ones take longer. They take a long time to make. Pete's Dragon was 3 years, and we've been working on the Peter Pan and Wendy script for 4 years at this point. And when we start, if we had started production when we had planned, it would have been about, 14 months from start to finish before it came out, and that is pretty fast for one of those movies. But still, it's a chunk of time. And you can make a movie like Ghost Story or Old Man the Gun much more quickly. And so when I'm done making a big one and I want to make something else, it's just a little bit easier to get a smaller movie off the ground. So that's where that back and forth comes from. I'm sure at some point, if I'm lucky enough, I'll make back-to-back big movies. And I hate calling them big, they're all big. Green Knight was way bigger than Pete's Dragon in terms of what we were trying to do. It's like Pete's Dragon is a pretty little movie when it all is said and done. It's not a lot of characters, not a lot of locations, mostly in the woods, and there just happens to be a giant dragon that that was very expensive. But Green Knight, is a far more epic movie, and the budget was vastly smaller. It was a fraction of Pete's Dragon. But it's a much bigger movie, so it you know the back and forth doesn't really ultimately. It's not as binary as it sounds, because every movie's different, and so you could break it down to Disney movies versus A24 movies because it kind of seems like that's where I'm going right now with a little Fox Searchlight mixed in. But it really for me just comes down to. My taste in movies is vast, and I want to make all types of films. And ultimately, they're all going to feel kind of the same because I'm making them. But, like that box I talked about earlier, the box that the movie fits in is going to just keep changing shapes and sizes because, whether it's a deep-seated obsession or a passing fancy, I'll have an idea that will be different from something I've made before, and it'll need a different size box to put it in.
And finally, I suppose that almost seems like the perfect kind of question to leave it on. You obviously we're all in lockdown just now. what kind of films, books, in addition to sort of Star Wars or podcasts, what are you kind of reading and watching just now that you would maybe recommend people to maybe watch during their sort of lockdown spell?
I mean, Mad Max Fury Road was, you know, it's one of my favorite movies of the past ever. It's one of my favorite movies. And it proved to be particularly therapeutic when I watched it last week. Really, really good movie to watch right now, I would say. I had never seen really any Louis Malle movies. I'd seen Pretty Baby a long time ago, and I'd seen My Dinner with Andre. And I got that Criterion box set of the Wallace Shawn, Andre Gregory movies, and I was watching those. And so I watched My Dinner with Andre again, then watched Vanya on 42nd Street, and was like, you know what, I've never seen any Louis Malle movies. So they're all on the Criterion channel. And I also just got a bunch of them on Blu-ray from Criterion because I like physical media, and just decided to just go through all of his movies one at a time. And I've been doing that, and it's just been fantastic. And I'm like, how have I missed out on this guy? I got to Atlantic City, and was just like, this is, like, how did I never see this movie before? This is a perfect movie. And then Zazie Dans Le Metro was just a lightning bolt. And I was like, thank God I watched this movie right now, because I'm working on this movie, this Peter Pan movie. And, like, I was like, this is the type of energy this movie needs to have, like. And now I'm like revisiting certain sequences and the storyboards and being like, this is the energy I've been missing. And so just, I'm really grateful that I decided to watch it, because it's going to be very helpful as when and if we get back to making Peter Pan, Wendy. But anyway, going through his body of work has just been really wonderful. And I would recommend that to anyone, because the movies are just really, really good. And they're all very different. Every one of them is different, and that's really exciting to see, because I certainly like doing that myself. And then last fall, I watched every Miyazaki movie from start to finish. There's a podcast I really like called Blank Check with David and Griffin that I've been a guest on a few times, and they break down directors' filmographies one movie at a time. And last fall, they were covering Miyazaki, and so I'd only ever seen a few of his movies, and I liked them, but didn't, you know, they weren't necessarily my cup of tea whenever I saw them at the time. And so I just started from the beginning, and if they weren't my cup of tea then, they sure were now. Like, I love them. I just became enraptured, and I was like, why did I not respond to this earlier? Why have these not been some of my favorite movies of all time until now? And so that was all last fall, but right now, I feel like I kind of just want to start over again and rewatch all of his movies, because it felt so nourishing. Like, his work was just so enriching and made me feel better about life in a lot of ways. So right now it feels like a really good time to dive into his filmography and watch those one at a time, starting at the beginning and getting to The Wind Rises. And you know, hopefully we'll get a new movie from him at some point. Maybe not this year, but next year, and that'll be a nice thing to look forward to.
Well, I'm looking forward to your films in the future as well. But honestly, thank you so much for talking with me today. As I say, Ghost Story and your filmography have been real standouts for me. And I mean, like, our podcast artwork is clearly inspired by a Ghost Story, and I have the Quad poster in a tube. Amazing. Just waiting to be put up. So, you know, it's been a real pleasure.
Awesome, thank you. I really appreciate it.